Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly.
Good morning. It's time for Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy with your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth. This program will improve the quality of your life through a system called resonance repatterning. And now, here's your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth.
Welcome to Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy. This week, I'll be talking with Jean Liedloff, author of The Continuum Concept, In Search of Happiness Lost, about the Yukuana Indians and what they teach us. Jean lived in the jungles of Venezuela with the Yukuana Indians, and her experience, from our point of view, directly relate to the resonance repatterning system, which these Living in Tune radio shows are all about. In resonance repatterning, we recognize that some of our most important life needs were not met in the womb, the birth process, the first year of life, and in our childhood. As a result, we no longer resonate with life being safe, with the possibility that our needs can be met, with life as a joyful adventure. Instead, we move into resonance with guilt, shame, unworthiness, loss of self-confidence, blame, criticism, and competition. Life becomes a game of survival rather than an adventure of joy lived with energy. The resonance repatterning system provides us with a way to bypass our talking left hemisphere and to access the field of infinite possibilities, as it's called in new physics, to discover the exact unconscious patterns we resonate with that underlie our present problems in our work, relationships, health, security, and so on. Resonance repatterning also allows us to transform the life-depleting patterns we resonate with so we regain our ability to express our authentic self, the essence of who we are, unhindered by our survival compensations. Now, what excites me about talking with Jean today is that she experienced for herself what it is to live with a group of people, the Yukuana Indians, whose life needs were met from the womb to their first year and in their childhood. The way the Yukuana Indians live has powerful lessons for us. The great English poet John Milton wrote his famous poem called Paradise Lost and also Paradise Regained. And we're all looking for that happiness we lost. What Jean will be sharing with us points the way to finding a certain aspect of that happiness. So welcome, Jean, to Living in Tune, Turn Your Problems into Joy. Are you there with us?
Yes, I am, Chloe. Hello.
Wonderful. Hello. And Jean, what I'd like to do is to start by asking you about some of your experiences before we go into learning and the concepts you drew from these experiences. Mm-hmm. It kind of will give people a background, I think, of the Yukuana and the Indians of the Venezuelan jungles. And one of the first things you observed about yourself and your diamond exploring partners was a different way of responding from the Yukuana and the Toripon Indians who were with you. The Western approach and the Yukuana approach to checking upstream over rocks and bypassing waterfalls with a heavy canoe and supplies were totally different, weren't they?
And well, among other things, yes.
And maybe we can just start with that story to kind of give people a sense of the difference.
Well, which story do you mean? You mean
well, when you were with your partners and you were trekking upstream, carrying that canoe
up. Oh, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. When we were, because there was another sort of little story I thought you might be referring to when I asked an Indian, should we go over the mountain or should we go by the river? And he said, yes.
Incredible.
Which, you know, it's just one of those things, you know, it's like you ask a child, are you a boy or a girl? And he says, yes.
That's right. And so what was this difference then in attitude? So that story too, but so this...
No, I know what you... I think I know what you mean.
The frustration. The frustration of you and the two explorers you were with. And
yes, the two Italians.
That's right. And then the complete different approach of the Yukuana as they were in the same situation that you were in.
Yes, and I was beginning to understand what I was looking at, but for a long time one simply doesn't. One takes for granted that one's customary viewpoint is it, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so we were portaging a canoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a really fierce rapids, you have to get out of the canoe.
Yes.
And walk the canoe. You know, you can't sit in it and expect, you know, to just go ahead.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes it's so bad you have to portage the canoe over, you know, a mountain or whatever,
mm.
or over a hill or a piece of land.
Mm.
But this was one in which we were pushing the canoe. We were all outside the canoe and holding onto the gunwales and pushing it along. And, you know, as we were going, you know, we would be hitting our ankles on the rocks and I had to precede this by saying that before, a couple of days before getting to this Arapuchi Falls rapids, the Italians were already saying, oh, it's going to be awful. In other words, we sort of dampened the pleasure of the 2 days before by contemplating going over this terrible rapids, you see.
Yes.
Okay, so that was unnecessary, you know,
mm-hmm.
making us less happy than we had to be.
Yes.
And anyway, when we got there, there were these rocks, and we had to sort of push the thing up and going heave-ho, you know, and
yes.
as we gave each push. And what they did was, you know, they used the Indian version of, you know, okay, go, and then, you know.
Yes.
In other words, you get ready. It's like ready, steady, go.
That's right.
So as this was going on, everyone was giving a push, and then, you know, you'd slip, and you bark your ankles, and that would hurt.
Yeah.
And then you'd push a little bit more, and then you'd slip, and you'd go backwards.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was rather frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that the Italians, who not only cued me and themselves to be unhappy at the prospect of doing this for 2 days before we got there, but while we were there, they were frowning and complaining and saying, oh, you know, really, you know. But they were Tuscans, so they were swearing. They're very, very specialized in swearing in Tuscany. So they had this, you know, their word, you know, like porca madonna, things like that. You can imagine what that meant. And, you know, and they would be swearing at their... you know, their punishment on these rocks and
yes.
in the water. And occasionally somebody would maybe slip off and have to be caught, you know, and put back on the side of the canoe. But the Indians, who were doing exactly the same thing, they were pushing the canoe, they were, you know, barking their ankles occasionally and slipping and so forth. But instead, every time they slipped, they would laugh.
Mm.
At it, you know.
Mm.
I mean, just you suddenly. I mean, I at a certain point realized that one had a choice, and I had never thought of that before.
Yes.
You know, you can laugh, or you can complain.
Yes.
You can suffer, or you can choose not to.
Yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
That was. I mean, that was my first expedition, and very early in the expedition, so I began to sort of learn that there are other ways of seeing and doing things.
Yes.
So,
and that was a typical response, that they would just be happy and joking and laughing.
Yeah, at what was happening. I mean,
yes.
when they slipped, that was a particularly funny thing. And when we slipped,
Yes.
or whatever it was, you know.
Yes.
Some swearing or being unhappy about it.
So basically you began to see this basic difference in response between you and the Yaquana. And you
well, it was one manifestation of it. I mean, there were much more important manifestations that I began to see. I mean, what I call the unlearning process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have to be that way, or according to the words of the song, it ain't necessarily so.
That's right. And you also saw that with the Yaquana women, didn't you? For instance, that trek that they would make down the steep mountainside to fetch water from the river.
Oh yeah, that was later on, different set of Indians, but you know, it was the same.
And so again, what did you notice with your response to this water trek and their response?
Well, my first response was they're cuckoo, they're crazy. You know, what's the matter with them?
Mm.
Why do you know they take a few little gourds, like two or three little gourds, hooked onto their fingers, you know, and go down to the river or the stream? near the village and fill these things with water and bring them back. Now, to get down to the water, you had to walk, and when you got near the river or the stream, it was really a little stream that I was talking about at that time. When you got nearby, it was wet. The bank nearest the stream was wet. So it was wet mud and very slippery.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to walk really carefully. And I thought, oh, damn, you know, this is awful. And I was suffering over the fact that one had to make an effort, you know, you had to concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why that should be an effort when you have a perfectly good brain, I don't know, but we think of it as, you know, unpleasant when you have to, you know, make an effort as yes. opposed to not making an effort.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And also, I noticed that when they went down, I thought, well, you know, these silly savages, why don't they build their village closer to the water so they don't have to march up and down several times a day? And then when I, you know, I thought about it afterwards because I was too silly to think of it at the time. When they went down, they usually go down there in maybe twos or threes and chatter with each other and maybe tell jokes, but it was all very pleasant. We were walking together, and they'd go down. And when they got there, they would, you know, usually give themselves, if the babies they were carrying, they'd give, you know, splash water on them, give them a bath. And the whole thing was fun. It was pleasant, you know, for them.
Yes.
So, and you say, well, why do they, you know, make themselves walk down this thing several times a day and then carry the water up? Well, why not? What would I have been doing? What would they have been doing? It would have been more pleasant. This was totally pleasant.
Yes.
You see?
Yes. So it's a whole different attitude towards time, isn't it?
Yes, or, you know, it has a lot to do with choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, I mean, they weren't conscious of making a choice. What they were doing was what they'd always seen being done since
yes.
they were babies themselves.
Yes.
And, you know, they would walk down, and they had this kind of almost a swagger, you know, not really a swagger, but almost, you know, looking sort of proud as they walked down together carrying their babies. Do you know?
Yes.
There was no sort of hunching or looking displeased.
Yes.
And they, you know, this pleasure of being with babies was something I noticed later. In all kinds of manifestations, the fact that children, the favorite pastime of children is taking care of babies.
Mm.
It's what they love most.
Ah.
And they're very good at it, you know, I mean, these little things, taking care of littler things.
Yes.
Carrying them, you know, you say to a baby, it's almost as big as a child who's taking care of it, marching around lugging this huge baby. it was their favorite thing. You know, a couple of times, you know, there was one who would sing her little song. The song, I remember the song, this is the Equana little
Jean,
girl.
Jean, unfortunately we have a commercial break coming up, so can we just come back to the story on the song in a few moments?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
It's how you conduct yourself through the chances that you take.
Listening on a higher dimension. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher.
Is the key to life more than just another technique? In Chloe Wordsworth's new book, Quantum Change Made Easy, she shows that what you resonate with is the key to all positive change, self-healing, and achieving the best of who you are. Chloe introduces you to the 9 keys of the resonance repatterning system for harmonizing your energy and turning your problems into joy. You can order Quantum Change Made Easy at Amazon.com or your local bookstore. To have a session, go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for certified practitioners. You can also learn to do sessions on yourself by attending Resonance Repatterning seminars. Experience the magic of helping yourself and others with a system that combines scientific and spiritual principles. Go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for seminars, practitioners, and self-healing products. Listen to Chloe on the 7th Wave Network every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time.
Listen closely because I'm about to ask you something that has probably never crossed your mind. Did you know that physical illness, depression, toxic relationships, financial struggles, even obesity, all have their roots in dysfunctional family patterns? Liz Tobin, a certified resonance repatterning practitioner, can help you begin to heal today. This breakthrough technique enables you to create positive change in any area of your life. You will effortlessly respond differently to situations and begin to attract new scenarios and opportunities in your life. Here is what people are saying about the Clearing Family Patterns Proxy Group.
This is planetary healing on a group level.
I've had this constant backache my whole life. It disappeared after just one session.
When you join the Clearing Family Patterns Proxy Group, you can clear these patterns. You'll be amazed at how each session seems tailored just for you. Try a free demonstration today. Learn more at LizTobin.com.
Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher. Learn to trust your wings, and the rest will follow after.
You're listening to Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy with your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth. Now back to the program. Here's Chloe.
Back with Jean Liedloff, who spent time in the jungles of Venezuela with this...
2.5 years.
How many years?
2.5.
2.5 years with the Yaquana Indians and learned some pretty amazing
and
things.
And or other Indians.
Yes, and the Toripan and other ones as well. That's right. And you were saying that this the children, their favorite pastime was looking after the babies.
Hmm.
And one of them, you said, had a song?
Yeah, I remember the song because it was this little girl who was just her own initiative. She used to sing, Si tu qua, 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 and sort of rocking the baby, and she'd be sitting in a hammock and rocking back and forth in the hammock, swinging
yes.
back and forth.
Yes.
Si tu qua is a Yaquana word for baby.
So,
you know, it wasn't very inventive, but it was... The baby liked it.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, that's right. And she had that contact. Now, Jean, one of the Yaquana Indian qualities was their great strength, you know, their ability to carry heavy burdens at a great distance, at actually much more than the Western men with their strong muscles. And I remember Anchu, one of the people there.
Well, he was the sort of more or less chief person.
Yes. And he had this wonderful lesson for you when you traded a brooch for 7 stalks of sugarcane. And would you share that lesson with us? Because it was the whole thing of, again, carrying burdens and the attitude of mind that goes with that, that was so different from their attitude.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah.
That was the one where you...
I was getting some sugarcane. I had
you got the sugarcane, and instead of the two men carrying the sugarcane for you over the two mountains, he actually had you carry one of the heavy cane stalks.
Well, he decided what was appropriate for me to carry, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say that, but you could see. And we went down to get the cane, and only women cut cane for some reason, it's a custom. Mm-hmm. And his wife was cut the cane, and then this fellow I call his butler, who was actually a Sanimay Indian, but they each took three canes, you know, three
mm-hmm. The stalks
of sugar cane, and then Anchu handed me one, and I felt slightly outraged. You know, I don't want to, because I didn't like to carry anything up those hills because I wanted to keep my hands free. And, you know, it was always burdensome for me to walk up hills because I wasn't as accustomed to it.
That's right.
And, but anyway, he handed it to me. And as we walked up, I got a whole new message about sharing a burden with people.
Mm.
You know, going up together. And, you know, I mean, it's very different having somebody else do it. And I didn't understand until I had to do it myself. And then I realized that we were doing it. It wasn't they or I, but we.
Yes.
And it's a very sort of different kind of a... And I don't know whether Anchu had that in mind, but he was very often teaching me lessons. Actually, one lesson that he tried to teach me that didn't take, but... I had a note. I always had notebooks with me, you know, lined notebooks. and I would be writing notes or thoughts or whatever. And at one point, and they didn't know what that was because there's no such thing as reading or writing or books or anything. This was deep in the jungle, so they would never have seen it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Anshu, he saw me, I guess, sitting near the river or something, writing in my journal, and he came up to me as though he had in mind to let me know this because, you know, he would be teaching me. And, you know, I felt that he was caring for me, you know.
Yes.
He would let me know what was right and what was wrong. And he pointed to these squiggly lines, which were my writing, you know, between the lines ruled on the notebook.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be doing page after page of this. And he said, look me in the eye as if to say this is significant. And he said, this is loco, because he knew a few words of Spanish. And he said, this is crazy. Thing to do, writing, because, I mean, he knew what human beings did, what was necessary, you know, gathering food, sharing things,
yeah.
Telling jokes. That was a very big thing with all of the Indians, is telling jokes and laughing. And, you know, taking care of each other and taking care of themselves and staying out of the rain, you know. But
yeah.
This thing didn't make any sense at all. They wanted to let me know this was a crazy thing to do. Well, I mean, later I wrote this book, you see.
Yeah.
So as I say, the lesson didn't take. But it was interesting, you know, the idea of what is and what is not crazy.
Yes.
Or what's a reasonable thing to do for a human being, a human activity.
Mm-hmm.
And this one didn't make any sense.
And, you know, and I also like that story going back to the sugar cane because, again, the attitude of mind that when you were carrying heavy burdens that the Westerners would get tired, whereas the Indians don't get tired, do they?
Well, of course, they're used to.
But they have a very different attitude toward it. You said that you kind of found your own pace, and there was no competition, and you didn't have to prove yourself.
Yes, I mean, I was constantly, you know, under pressure because I was a girl, you know, and everyone else was male.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the whole female of the species on my shoulders.
That's right.
Our honor. And, I mean, Professor Vinci, who was the leader of the second expedition, the first time we went to see the Equana and everything, he used to tell Enrico, who insisted upon bringing me along, that the jungle was no place for girls, and I don't know what, and I was just going to be a burden and useless and everything else. But the Europeans aren't used to being without psychological pressure, going up and down, as you say, competitiveness and so forth. I mean, I had to prove that females were not inferior and we could go at our own pace. But Anshu, when we went up with the sugar cane, there was no, I mean, I didn't feel I had to keep up with them.
Mm-hmm.
They, because Anshu already knew that I was going to be slower than they,
mm-hmm.
So he put me first. So they followed me and we all went together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
But there
very, very different understanding.
What?
Well, of just the team working together.
Yes, but the idea that I had to, I mean, he just, I think, you know, thoughtfully put me first so that I was the one who could set the pace.
That's right.
Because, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to keep up and we couldn't have been together.
Yeah.
So for the sake of teammateness, you know.
Yes, and being together.
Yeah, he put the weakest link ahead and you know.
Yes.
And expected me to do what I did.
Yes.
Did what I did and they followed.
Whereas in the West, we, you know, the strong ones go first and then we blame or criticize the person who's holding things up.
Yeah, that's right, and the one who is lagging behind feels inferior and apologetic and
that's right.
Embarrassed and all that. And also, I think when we went down there to cut the sugar cane, and there was a piece of Venetian glass that I had actually got in Venice, and I had with me for some reason, and they'd seen it and they wanted it, and I said, well, I would, you know, I'd trade it for some sugar cane.
Yes.
And then we went down with Anshu and his wife and this, what I called the butler, who was a Sanimai Indian. And we cut, he cut, the wife cut the cane and brought the stalk and put it on the ground, and then he put another one and another one. And after they had done six, Anshu said, how many? To me.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was leaving it to me to strike a decent, fair bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suddenly realized, I hadn't got it, you know. Then I suddenly realized it, and I said, okay. So I said, one more. Because they were bringing it in twos, you know, the wife
yes.
bringing it in twos. So I said, one more. And so we had seven. But, you know, then I realized that there was this totally different thing of making a bargain and a trade where the assumption was that both people had fairness in mind, you know, really. In other words, I was to say what I felt this piece of gloss from Murano was worth.
Yes.
And he was going to respect it because he respected me,
huh.
and I respected him, and we were human beings, respectable human beings. You know? So
whereas
there was none of that little sort of subtext of, you know, how much can I get out of this person, you know?
That's right.
That wasn't even there.
And if you'd gone there and were seeing how many stalks you could get out of him, would he have stopped you at a certain point or what?
Well, who knows?
Mm.
I know that he didn't stop me when I, you know, when I stopped at seven and just, and I suddenly got the message that he
yes.
was asking me
yes.
quietly, not dramatically or anything.
Yes, yes.
But
that understanding of fairness.
In other words, what was this strange-looking bauble that I had, you know, piece of glass, you know, Venetian glass, you know, that sort of jewelry and stuff that they
That's
make
right.
in the island of Murano. And luckily, I didn't embarrass my race, got the message, behaved like a lady. You know?
Yeah. So now, Gina, in the West, children fight and compete and often hurt each other. How did the Yaquana Indian children treat each other?
Well, that's amazing. You know, at a certain point, I had an advocate who happened to be in the White House, a fellow called Adam Yarmolinsky, and I met him at a cocktail party in New York, and we started talking, and he was so interested. And we finished talking when the sun was coming up.
Mm.
And by the time, you know, he totally, and I hadn't written my book or anything, and I was just thinking these thoughts and gathering them together and, you know, changing my mind about all kinds of things about human nature. And he was very interested, and he then became my greatest advocate, and his office at that point happened to be in the White House,
mm-hmm.
no less. So he would ring people up from the White House and tell them about my ideas, and people who would never have given me the time of day, professors at Harvard and so forth, they would pay attention because he rang them. And one of these was maybe you will have heard of him, Professor Jerome Kagan, who was, something to do with child psychology or something like that. Mm-hmm. There was another Jerome up there at Harvard, the Center for Cognitive Studies at Harvard, called Jerome Bruner, and he was also very famous, both of them. But I remember when Adam Yarmolinsky rang up Jerome Kagan and told him he has to talk to me and told him to telephone me. And he rang up and he said, I've forgotten in what context, but I said, you know, the children play together unsupervised all day and they never fight. And he said he'd never heard of such a thing because he was a student of child behavior.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, we have a break we need to go to right now, but we will be back in 1 minute.
Okay, and then we'll talk about what's called normal.
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
How you conduct yourself through the chances that you take.
Awakened Media for a transforming world. Seventh Wave Network.
Marissa, are you ready yet? I know you can hear me. You are not missing school again. Marissa! You trying to be a nobody or something? Let's go! All right, then. Hit it. I know you can hear this. Hey, guys, move closer. That's it. Girl, I am not leaving.
Hey, whatever it takes, don't let your friends drop out. A real friend can make all the difference.
Cut that noise, yo! I'm coming!
Took you long enough. Thanks for the help, guys.
For more ways to help, go to OperationGraduation.com. A public service message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher.
Is the key to life more than just another technique? In Chloe Wordsworth's new book, Quantum Change Made Easy, she shows that what you resonate with is the key to all positive change, self-healing, and achieving the best of who you are. Chloe introduces you to the 9 keys of the Resonance Repatterning System for harmonizing your energy and turning your problems into joy. You can order Quantum Change Made Easy at Amazon.com or your local bookstore. To have a session, go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for certified practitioners. You can also learn to do sessions on yourself by attending Resonance Repatterning seminars. Experience the magic of helping yourself and others with a system that combines scientific and spiritual principles. Go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for seminars, practitioners, and self-healing products. Listen to Chloe on the Seventh Wave Network every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time.
Taking you to the threshold of a dream and beyond. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher. Learn to trust your wings.
You're listening to Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy with your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth. Now back to the program. Here's Chloe.
So back here with Jean Lee Loft talking about her experiences of living in the jungles of Venezuela with the Yaquana Indians.
And also living in civilization.
And civilization. And you were talking about this professor at Harvard and what was normal. So tell that story about Kagan, then.
Well, I told him that when I was living with these Indians that I never saw two children fight, that they play together all day, unsupervised. And I never saw them not only not fight, but never argue, which, you know, didn't make any sense to him because he was an expert on what is normal. Well, what's the norm here? Normal is, as you say, aggressive, angry, hitting each other, yes, shouting at each other, sulking, all kinds. Well, you know what normal is here.
That's right.
It ain't pretty, but
yes,
we think it is normal. It's like, you know, when a baby is born, everyone said, oh, it's crying. That's normal. All babies cry. Well, interestingly enough, the Equana babies didn't cry. I mean, in a very rare instance, they might whimper a little bit, that kind of thing.
Yes.
But screaming, I never heard at all. In the 2.5 years I was with them and the Sanimoy Indians and the Tauripan, they just don't have any cause to scream.
Yes.
So normal is not what we want. What we want is less normal and more natural.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, eventually I realized, you know, after my fifth expedition, I got fed up with the Italians and on the first two expeditions leading the expedition, then I led 3 expeditions myself.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, I thought, well, I've been, you know, learning things that are so surprising and important.
Yes.
That I really should be sharing this with my own tribesmen, all the Western world.
That's right.
And
Jean, you had that extraordinary story about the small boy whose friend shot an arrow into his stomach.
It was his brother.
His brother. And again, I mean, share that story because the response is so different from the Western response.
Yeah, well, by that time I was used to these weird reactions. Yes, it was a Watahu who got shot, and his elder brother, Katawehu, who shot him. And, I mean, And they, by this time, had regarded me as their doctor because I used to, well, from the first expedition on, I was, you know, when anyone was wounded or ill or something, they don't have medicine or any conception of hygiene. So I would just, from the first expedition when I was treating an Indian who had a piece of rotten wood fall out of a tree and open his scalp up, and I ended up sewing it up with dental floss. And, it was an incredible gift to me to become a doctor without any training. Just because I cared and I wanted to help a fellow human being, you know. So I got this reputation, which followed me for the whole five expeditions, of being, well, the doctor or the shaman or whatever. And then the Indians used to bring people from miles around who were ill or dying. Or about to die, and by this time I was going to drug companies and things, and getting all kinds of drugs and supplies, on purpose.
Yes.
Kind of things I would encounter, and I wasn't using dental floss anymore.
So this child then came to you because he'd been shot in his stomach.
Yeah, so he came to me naturally, a Wadahoo. And with an arrow, so we took the arrow out. And apparently Katawehu, Katawehu, I guess, would be about 2 years older. In fact, they were the sons of Anshu.
Mm-hmm.
The most, I don't know you'd call them, we call them a chief, because I don't know, but
mm-hmm.
They were sort of the people of the village of Anshu, and they had most highly regarded him. But anyway, so I was treating the wound, you see. I was cleaning it or doing whatever I had to do with it. And the other children were standing around watching. And the mother turned up. And she stood around watching. And, oh, she came around. She said, what happened? And, she could see that there's an arrow being taken out. And they said, Katawehu shot an arrow and it landed in the stomach of a Wadahoo. Well, she didn't question why Katawehu would do a thing like that, because she knew he wouldn't have done it on purpose. She didn't have to ask.
Mm-hmm.
It was just inconceivable.
Mm-hmm.
And she just watched this proceeding going on just with quiet curiosity and, of course, concern for her son. But there was no blame or anger or funny business that you would have expected if one brother had shot another one.
Yes, and no fear.
What?
And no fear.
Well, I don't know if she was fearful or not, because, I mean, she had every reason to think, if an arrow goes into someone, I think they tend to get infected and die. But by this time they knew, well, actually they had a rather weird impression of my doctoring skills, because no one ever died. So I guess they thought it was some, whatever, magic, or, in other words, Western medicine never fails. I think that was the impression they got.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's not true, but, I mean, it just happened. I was just lucky.
But in terms of the two children, the one who had been shot, he also wasn't upset or blaming his brother. And
not in the least. Well, he knew. I mean, there was no question in his mind that Katawehu would never have done that to him.
That's right.
On purpose.
That's right. But again, in the West, if that had happened even by accident, there would have been a reaction, screaming and crying and anger and upset and all the rest of it.
Yes, it would have been a superficial demonstration of this anger that we expect to reside in all children.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it
doesn't.
It does. We have this terrible undercurrent of anger in all our children, I find, and it's the greatest tragedy.
Yes.
Because of the infancy and childhood, toddlerhood that we've had, we have all this anger, and we get something like, what was the name of that school, Columbine, or what was the name of that?
Yes, that's right.
And everybody, at the end of one of these things, somebody shoots up everyone in the cafeteria or the gymnasium or something, and everyone afterwards, they cool down and say, why? Well, if you read my book, you'll know why.
That's right.
Because we're all sort of submerging this anger, So I think a word that you didn't mention, which I'd like to mention, is that my notion of the continuum concept
is that
human beings have expectations. Mm-hmm. We have expectations that we're going to have the kind of experience that we had during the hundreds of thousands of years during which we evolved as a species. So I think, it's not too far-fetched to imagine that if you, you know, if your species for hundreds of thousands of years emerge into consciousness, you know, come out of the womb, and you were immediately held close to your mother and nursed and then remained in physical contact. And if you got out of physical contact, you would cry. But that wouldn't happen. I mean, I know the equina didn't let anyone get out of physical contact, so nobody cried. But with us, the minute, do you remember those old films where the baby is born upstairs and then they hear it cry?
Yeah.
The father say, oh, great, and hands us cigars?
Yeah.
Well, the point is that we are actually so crazy that we are pleased, we smile and are happy when we hear a baby cry.
Mm-hmm.
It means that he's alive or something, but he's suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a cry, wah.
Yeah.
You don't need a dictionary to understand that is suffering and that it's calling for help. It's calling to have its experience changed to something appropriate.
Yes.
That makes sense what I'm saying?
That's right. And so basically the Yaquana and the Toripan Indians, they kept their baby with them all the time.
And
always
the Sanima and every other ones that I... So, and also the people in Bali, they're the only civilized people I ever happened to encounter who were very, very continuum correct, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't hear, you know, people sometimes remark, well, most people don't notice it. You see people walking around with babies, and the babies are not crying.
Yes.
And they say, well, that's odd, you know, the babies never cry. Well, okay, you know.
Yes, so basically what you're saying then is that the Indians keep their babies with them 24 hours a day.
In contact.
In contact, and that they are moving constantly.
Well, no, I mean, they go to sleep at night.
I know, but I mean, during the day, they're with their mother, and the mother is moving and jiggling around and up and down.
Well, she's just doing what is she would be doing. I mean, she's either walking,
right,
or she's cooking, or maybe she's just sitting down and having a conversation or something. She doesn't have to be jiggling.
No, but it's
but
very
when
different.
She's jiggling, the baby could, for example... I mean, it would talk about really jiggling if they're having a kind of a party at night and they're dancing, which is really stomping, you know, because she's just hopping from one foot to the other, sort of stomp. And this, obviously the girls are holding their babies, and the babies' heads are bouncing up and down.
Yeah.
And the heads never fall off.
That's right.
And the babies don't wake up.
Yeah, we have another commercial break right now. We will be back in a minute.
It's about your journey long way. It's how you conduct yourself through the chances that you take.
Your online community for positive change. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher.
Is the key to life more than just another technique? In Chloe Wordsworth's new book, Quantum Change Made Easy, she shows that what you resonate with is the key to all positive change, self-healing, and achieving the best of who you are. Chloe introduces you to the 9 keys of the resonance repatterning system for harmonizing your energy and turning your problems into joy. You can order Quantum Change Made Easy at Amazon.com or your local bookstore. To have a session, go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for certified practitioners. You can also learn to do sessions on yourself by attending Resonance Repatterning seminars. Experience the magic of helping yourself and others with a system that combines scientific and spiritual principles. Go to ResonanceRepatterning.net for seminars, practitioners, and self-healing products. Listen to Chloe on the 7th Wave Network every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time.
Listen closely because I'm about to ask you something that has probably never crossed your mind. Did you know that physical illness, depression, toxic relationships, financial struggles, even obesity, all have their roots in dysfunctional family patterns? Liz Tobin, a certified resonance repatterning practitioner, can help you begin to heal today. This breakthrough technique enables you to create positive change in any area of your life. You will effortlessly respond differently to situations and begin to attract new scenarios and opportunities in your life. Here is what people are saying about the Clearing Family Patterns Proxy Group.
This is planetary healing on a group level.
I've had this constant backache my whole life. It disappeared after just one session.
When you join the Clearing Family Patterns Proxy Group, you can clear these patterns. You'll be amazed at how each session seems tailored just for you. Try a free demonstration today. Learn more at liztobin.com.
The new home for visionary positive change. Seventh Wave Network.
Learn to fly. You are the teacher. Learn to trust your wings, and the rest will follow after.
You're listening to Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy with your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth. Now back to the program. Here's Chloe.
Yes, so Jean, you were saying that the mothers, when they're dancing, the babies are fast asleep and their heads are bopping up and down and they don't even wake up, which is very different than from the West, where babies are put in a pram or they're put into a cot and they don't have that natural movement when from being with their mothers.
And I'm not talking so much about the movement as the contact.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not advocating moving so much as that if you happen to be moving. Now, for example, if you were, we have an idea that for a baby to sleep, or for anybody to sleep, they have to be in something dark and quiet.
That's right.
But what I'm telling parents who consult me to do is, in the evening, instead of having bedtime or sleepy time for the baby or for the child or for anybody, just do whatever you're doing. I mean, you might be in the living room, talking with friends or talking with your husband or just watching the television or whatever, and just let the baby fall asleep wherever it is.
That's right.
It would be maybe with its head on your lap or with its feet on your lap, or it might be sleeping on your feet.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
In the noise and the light, and they'll just go to sleep. Just don't, you know, I mean, don't stop them from going to sleep or think, oh, he's going to sleep, I better quickly bundle them into a bed.
That's right.
Doesn't have to be in a bed. Can
and
sleep anywhere.
That's when babies scream, is when they have to go to bed.
Exactly.
Because
and
it's about separation from the parents.
One of the most ironical little scenes that you can see is they, after having pushed the baby into bed and finally got it to go to sleep, you know, after it's cried itself, exhausted, and then somebody tiptoes past the bedroom door, of the nursery door, and the baby hears a squeak from the floorboard. Oh, you woke the baby.
That's
the
right.
Point is, and the baby starts screaming. Why? Because not because they've been hurt, but because they hear some signs of life in the universe, and they're crying out for someone to come and get them.
That's right. So really,
the sound of life is not disturbing. It just gives hope.
Yes. So basically, the continuum concept is that we have requirements at each stage in our life, at what you call these expectations, and when our needs are fulfilled, we have a sense of rightness and well-being.
That's right, and confidence in ourselves. The two words that we really want to leave a baby and a child, and an adult, in fact, everybody with, is feeling worthy and welcome.
Yes.
And we don't. I've never felt welcome a day in my life because my mother made me feel I wasn't welcome.
Yes, that's right.
And it happens all the time. I mean, for example, just the simplest thing that you say to a child, be good.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean?
Yes.
It means pretend to be good because we know what you really like, you know, if you analyze it. I mean, otherwise, you wouldn't say to a child, be good. There wouldn't be any concept of not being good.
Mm.
So it would be a meaningless thing to say, you know, like you're going into a shop or you're going to visit someone or someone's coming to visit and you say, now, be good.
Mm-hmm. Whereas for the Aquana, there's no concept of a good boy or a bad boy.
That's right.
It's just simply you're a child and you act like a child.
Yeah, you act like you do. You decide how you, because they know exactly that human nature is social, not antisocial. We think it's antisocial by nature, and that you have to tame somebody, or what we call socializing them, in order to make them viable, make them tolerable.
Yes.
Because we've first driven them crazy, and then when they behave like that, we think there's something wrong with them. And as they all do it, you think, well, that's the child's nature, is to be contrary, try to get away with as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, in fact, the Yaquana assume from experience that children are social, that human beings are social animals.
Mm-hmm.
And the natural inclination is to do what we do.
Yeah.
And they regard, as we all do, our parents as the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And if your authority is someone who yells and screams and is drunk and crazy and beats up your mother or your father or whatever, that's what you think we do.
Yes. So and I noticed
your parents make you feel that you're a pest.
Yeah. You become
annoying or wrong,
mm-hmm.
which most of us do. We think, well, that's the thing to do, is to make them feel guilty, and that's going to make them good. It's just the opposite.
Mm. And I noticed that you were saying that nobody, you don't make a decision. The Yaquana don't make a decision for somebody else, like the young boy, 14-year-old. It's like you make your own decision, and they don't try to cajole or coerce you or manipulate you to make another decision.
Yes, well, they have a great deal of respect. I mean, Tadeha, that child you were talking about, or whatever age he was, I don't know whether he was 14 or 12 or whatever, and he decided he wanted to come traveling with me and whoever was with me. And his mother came to me at one point, or she did do this, which is rather, came to me and she said, don't take him home to your mother. Bring him back. You know? And then he went traveling off with me in my canoe and with the others, and, you know, we went and had adventures up the river and, you know.
Yes.
Went exploring. And Tadeha came along, you know. And, you know, he was fine, but they weren't trying to, you know, push him or forbid him or something like that. But she was, his mother was a bit worried, concerned about him. So she came to me and said, bring him back when you're finished.
But you were also saying that some of the other tribesmen left, and then they said, do you want to come with us? And he said, no. But he just, again,
that's right.
No cajoling, that every child makes a decision and they honor that.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, they can tell when a child is old enough to... But the fact that they make a decision signals them that they're old enough.
That's right. Yes.
Because, you know, a reasonable animal doesn't make a decision that it's not capable and is not appropriate, you know.
Yes. But I think in the West, again, children's decisions are not honored. They're not really acknowledged, that it's like other people are constantly making your decisions for you.
And then forcing them on you.
That's right. Yes.
Well, that's because we don't really believe in this principle that you don't make decisions that you're not able to make. You don't, you know, go where you're not capable. You're just like babies at the side of the river. The children who are a little bit older would go paddling around in the river or swimming or something, and the little babies, nobody stopped them,
mm-hmm.
but they would, you know, splash in the edges of the river. But they could be there.
Yes.
And no one was afraid they were going to go in the middle and drown themselves or anything.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, Jean, thank you. And it looks like we're running out of time at this point. But I think that your book, The Continuum Concept, has so many lessons for us. And I really recommend that people read this book. And
I hope they do. It really does change things for people.
It does. And it works so beautifully with resonance repatterning, which is really about, you know, accessing some of those old patterns that were set up, and so we can change our
resolution
them, and we don't have to continue to live the unnatural life. So thank you so much, Jean, for joining us today. I really appreciate your being here.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you, Chloe. You're very gracious.
Thank you. And next week, I hope you'll join us at Living in Tune. We have an interesting show of four successful people with big dreams talking about the power of resonance repatterning in their lives. And Glyn was a CFO of a worldwide Fortune 50 company. He's raised $25 million.
Oh, I thought you were going to say 25 children.
25 million. Yeah. Why is he drawn to resonance repatterning? And what has this system of healing done for him? Gary produces huge events and is committed to the planet makeover. Why does he swear by resonance repatterning? Jihan has done radio and TV shows, public presentations, facilitates millionaire attraction, law of attraction groups. And Lane is a high-powered woman who is successful in marketing. And the results that she, her husband, and three children have experienced through resonance repatterning. So join these four wonderful people, clients of practitioner Mary Schneider, who will also share specific repatternings with their permission of how did they move into healing and in what way. So remember, our new website will be up and running in the next month, and we invite all certified practitioners to list their name and specialties so our listeners can find you for a session. Go to resonancerepatterning.net and the e-store to sign up. And we invite our listeners to visit our sessions homepage and experience a life-changing session for yourself. If you email us at livingintune@gmail.com, I'll stay in touch with you through our monthly newsletter, and I'll let you know if I've done any new repatternings or any more live shows that I'll be doing. And remember, you can study this work and experience extraordinary life changes from our wonderful certified teachers, and of course I teach as well. So please go to our website and see what we offer. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you for listening to Living in Tune. Turn your problems into joy. Join your host, Chloe Faith Wordsworth, next Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Seventh Wave Network.
Today I saw the sun up in the sky. Tomorrow.